Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me tonight is my co-host, as always,
Chad Mintz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. So, Chad, I have a box office update for you.
That's right, that did happen this weekend.
Yes. So, obvious and aside from the actual winner of this weekend's box office, I think it is appropriate that we talk about the film that came in fifth place. The film that took in $3.7 million this weekend, bringing its total to $13.5 million. I think we should talk about Geostorm.
No! No! I used up enough of my airspace and life talking about Geostorm last time. Like, no! This right here is like 20 seconds too long. Talking about Geostorm. Geostorm is number 5 in the box office this week. Next.
It's a disappointment. It's a box office disappointment.
Are you really going to do this again? Are we really going to do this again?
I had to. So let's talk about happier things. Let's talk about real movie news. Let's talk about the film that's at number 1 at the box office this weekend. With a $120 million opening weekend. Surpassing that of Spider-Man Homecoming, which debuted at 117. Still coming, not coming as close to Guardians as they would like, but Thor Ragnarok made an awesome debut and a tremendous impact on the culture this weekend. I've seen it twice. Seen it the once. Let's talk about this movie. I mean, this is, oddly enough, I think the craziest Marvel movie that they've done.
Considering that we're also talking about, you know, the tree and the raccoon movie, for you to say that, is saying it's a bit out there, and I guess I would agree.
Do you realize how self-effacing this movie is? Like, they are taking pot shots at themselves all over the place. They take pot shots at Thor and his characterization. They have an entire play in which they mock the ending, one of the big emotional moments of the previous movie. They throw away Jane Foster like she's yesterday's news in like a throwaway line. Lady Sif doesn't even get that. The other two of the Warriors 3, the other three of the Warriors 4, technically, they all die really quickly.
Yeah.
Sif only survives because she had a scheduling conflict and she's allowed to be still out there in the ether because of that. They make fun of Joss Whedon with the lullaby from Age of Ultron. They make fun of Loki and his, you know, love of power by, you know, having him look at the Tesseract with a really keen eye. They do the whole villain problem. They address the whole villain problem with, you know, Helena being Loki and Thor's sister. Yes, full spoilers. I mean, they, like, it's they do the callback with Loki, you know, in the Avengers Hulk smash moment there in the gladiator fight. Like, they are self-referential all the way through this film. It is a wink, wink, nudge, nudge at themselves, which is far above anything I ever thought they would do.
I didn't expect that so much. And truth be told, I like, there's a lot of stuff that I caught. Like, I caught everything you said, but I never thought of it in that light. And when I got out of the movie, I was like, I need to see this again so I can, like, really see all these things. But I've heard
I saw it again right after.
Well, that's
good. Hence the reason why we didn't record a podcast.
Yeah, that is why I often say that you're insane. But, you know, this is not the most insane thing you've done. This is rather tame on your scale. But, that's why I want to watch it again, to catch the things that I caught, but to, like, really fully appreciate them.
So let's talk about our good, our not so good, and our bad, as we do typically with these movies. I'll start first with my good. I need more Valkyrie in my life. That is just an amazing, and the attempt, now that we've saved Lady Sif, the confrontation between Lady Sif and Valkyrie with Thor in the middle would be an awesome repartee to see. She is strong, she is valiant, she is haunted. you know, she has some real dramatic weight to her. She has good working relationships with both Banner and with both Hulk and Thor, not so much Banner. I love the shock and awe surprise that she has about, you know, who Banner actually is. And she's just a really, for as much as I talk about my female-driven characters, right? My women of the MCU, most of whom are sitting in a bar somewhere begging to be released. They did this one really well and really right. I mean, could you have done the whole hint, hint, nudge, nudge thing toward her sexual preferences? Sure, but that, you know, that's a calculated risk that you're going to take to anger some audience members and embolden some others, but ultimately at the end of the day, it doesn't shade her character enough, even if it's in there, to shape the narrative completely.
Well, apparently they shot like a very, you say explicit in this context, people think different things, but
she walks out of the bedroom.
Not so much she walks out of the bedroom, but there's another girl in there with her that is walking out, that is getting dressed while she's walking out. You get the implications there.
Strongly implied that there was multiple partners in that room.
Yes. That wouldn't bother me either way, but...
Right, but even if you take the context of what Tessa has said herself, which is, I consider the hot blonde girl that is, you know, falling on top of me in the Helena sequences, I've in my mind, that's my lover who is falling on top of me and she has just been killed. Mm-hmm. Even in that context, that's a very passionate subcontext to have for the character and for the movie, but it doesn't necessarily fundamentally change the character in any kind of way. Her sexuality doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Well, I guess for my good, I'm gonna give it to Thor, because nobody's ever gonna say they give anything good to Thor, because he's always, in all the other movies, it's always been like, Loki's been the star of this one, Loki's the star of this one. God damn it, Chris Hemsworth started this movie, and it's that he works well with all the other people around him, with Valkyrie, with the Hulk, with Banner, with Loki, and I think a lot of this, a lot of the things they went for, particularly with the humor, wouldn't work if Chris Hemsworth doesn't work. And he works really well in a comedy setting, as a lot of people don't know, because a lot of people haven't seen Vacation or Ghostbusters, but he's a funny dude. It's unfair that he's funny and he looks like that, but here we are. So Taika Waititi used what his actor does best, and without him, this whole thing probably is just like really, really stupid, actually. So I'm gonna give it to him.
I would agree. The only thing about that is that, like, Hemsworth's comedic timing has always been there. Even with all the fish out of water stuff in the first Thor movie, all the stuff in New Mexico, all the stuff with Kat Dennings and Natalie Portman and all that, that he showed that kind of chops there. And he definitely showed him in Avengers, where he had Whedon writing him. And there's some very good repartee there with him and the other Avengers in that first movie. It gets sidelined because the Dark World is such a detour away from everything else. I'd argue that Thor the Dark World and Iron Man 3 are probably the two most theme divergent from everything else Marvel has done. Like, and one's done really well and works for a lot of people, and the other one is the most derided movie in the history of the MCU. And the only reason I say that is because most people forget about the Incredible Hulk movie that had Edward Norton in it, which is technically MCU.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hate that movie. So, of the three, I'm gonna give it to Dark World. So, you know. But, I think this one, like, while he's done in all these other movies, this one is like, here, we're going to depend on your humor to run this whole thing, and you got to do it.
Right, and it's from the opening jump.
Yeah, we get pretty much the opening scene. Like, he starts off, I think, with the line from the first trailer, and then right after that line that cuts off in the trailer, there's a joke. So, that's like, that whole little opening scene sets the tone for the movie.
All right. What's your not so good?
My not so good is nothing particularly like within the context of the movie. It's just when once I was done with the movie, I was like, I really liked it, but like as I have not rushed out to go see it again, it's just kind of that's just kind of what it is. I liked it. I think it's good, but
a good episode of TV.
Kind of, yeah. I think I would like it more as I've separated from some and I watch it again. But as of right now, it's just like, yeah, it's good, but I don't have to see this again. Like, I love Spider-Man, and I know I am biased. I love Spider-Man. Like, I want to go watch this again, like, right now.
Which if you would have been me, you would have done.
Yeah, you know, well, I'm old. I can't do those kind of things anymore. But if I was younger, yeah, I wouldn't have left. I'd have been right back there again at, like, 10:30. But this one, I'm like, yeah. But there are parts I want to see. I want to see Thor and Hulk fight. There are jokes that I want to get. There are little Easter eggs that I missed that I want to get. Like the whole play with all the people involved in the play. And I knew they were in there, but I forgot about it watching the movie.
Yeah, the camera just sits on Damon's face.
Yeah, it's just
like him. It's plain of yeah, plain as day. Look, we got Matt Damon in a Marvel movie.
And I'm looking at him, and it doesn't even register. And
so, and you hear Sam Neill's voice as Odin, and
again, just completely, right. Just off the top of my head, and that they went and got the skinny Hemsworth to be Thor. Like, I just want to see all those kinds of
things. See, that joke would have worked for me better to me if it had been Liam. Liam? Just because of how derided Liam is for all of his work.
Yes, and that's exactly why they didn't go get Liam, because it's like, okay, this is supposed to be a joke, but now I am the joke, and that's not cool, man. So yeah, it's just, I just want to see it again, and once time goes, I know I'll probably appreciate it more. But just right now, it's just like, yeah, it's good. I'm good.
My not so good is a simple act that occurs in Odin's vault as Kate Blanchett is walking through, giving her tutorial on her history, which we'll get to later. There has been a major, the first really important sentinel moment of like Easter eggdom in the history of the MCU was in the original Thor movie. When at the beginning of the film, when the Frost Giants are coming in to try and take out, and then Destroyer comes in and takes them out, there is a shot of an Infinity Gauntlet sitting in Odin's vault. And this has propelled theories after Avengers, where we got the notification that Thanos would be the big bad. This perpetuated theories abounding on the internet for ages about why is that gauntlet there? Is that the one that Thanos is going to break in and steal because the Tesseract's already there? You know, and those theories just emboldened even more when Feige came out after Avengers Age of Ultron and said, the glove that, the door that opens up and the glove that Thanos puts on at the end of Age of Ultron is not the one in Odin's vault. Mm-hmm. So that fueled even more speculation about a potential Infinity Gauntlet versus Infinity Gauntlet end of all civilization as we know it collision in Avengers Infinity War. That has now been debunked quickly and easily and sleightly of hand in like 5 seconds.
Not even.
It's the first thing I texted Jim after it was over because I was like, did I see this right? Like, they just retconned this whole thing, right, in, like, 5 seconds? And he was like, yeah, that's totally what happened. So I was like, cool. So everything in Odin's vault, with the exception of a few things, are fakes. They're knockoffs. They're mm-hmm. replicas.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you get around that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the way you get around it. See, you don't just leave it dangling out there for, like, Infinity War. You don't have to pay it off in Infinity War.
See, we always have these little impasses where there's these things that you're like really, really high strung about, and I'm just like, eh.
5 seconds!
Well,
most of these things are fake. Fake pushes over the Infinity Gauntlet. It got a laugh in our screening.
And I think that, well, it's supposed to get a laugh.
It got a laugh in our screening. She's pushing over a thing that we thought was secretly hidden away in Odin's vault because eagle-eyed fans caught it in the first Thor movie.
But all those fans also saw Thanos grab his own Infinity Gauntlet and...
Out of his own little case.
And as far as I know, there's only one official Infinity Gauntlet. So they were going to fix it one way or another. So if you're not trying to change it where there's like more than one Infinity Gauntlet... No, there's only one. Well, you've established there's two. So how do we fix this?
But you've established it for nerds, people who follow the Nerd Apocalypse on Twitter. That's who you established it for. Like, eagle-eyed fans are who saw it and recognized it, and they were the ones pondering the theories about Infinity Gauntlet versus Infinity Gauntlet collisions, not Joe Blow fan who's seeing Thor Ragnarok because they like Chris Hemsworth's shirtless shots.
Well, to the deep nerds, like which I count myself among of, I never thought we were going to get an Infinity Gauntlet versus an Infinity Gauntlet thing. So I just completely... Once we got the one in Thanos' vault, then like, well, what's this thing with Thor's? We have to answer this because there are enough of us that know what it is that you have to do something with it. So what you're going to do? And what they chose to do was... We're going to quickly not spend any time on this. Just get rid of it.
It deserved its own movie, Chad.
It did not. And so did not. The reason that thing is in Thor in the first place is for fans. They put it there so they can get excited about something. And then this is what happens in the movie-making process.
That they didn't even know was going to be relevant for another year.
Exactly. So they put it there. It's fun. We can always do something with it later. And then once the story-making process happens, they're like, well, it makes more sense for Thanos to already have the gauntlet. Well, we already have it. We already put this one here. What are we going to do with it? I don't know. We'll figure that out later. And then it's like, well, we're here on Asgard. What are we going to do with it? Well, it's not the real one, right? No. Fake. Boom. Done. Done.
Sad face, Chet.
It can be a sad face.
Sad face. Continuity issues. Need deep resolutions.
No, they don't. For something that we glimpsed for 5 seconds in the first Thor movie that we haven't seen again until this Thor movie, to get the equal amount of screen time that it got in the first Thor movie and actually be acknowledged, I think that's doing pretty good for the fake Infinity Gauntlet. It is done. We don't need to spend any more time on it. It's gone.
So, just to check, Tesseract, which houses the Infinity Stone, real.
Yes.
Frost giant thing.
Real.
Real. Infinity Gauntlet, not real.
So, I mean, we didn't get to see what's all in Odin's vault, but we know.
Sutter's helmet. Real.
That's real. The Eternal Flame is real because we used that. The dang destroyer that was in there, that was real. So, the only thing really in there that's not real was the Infinity Gauntlet.
So, Odin was just like wanting to put a Infinity Gauntlet on display for some reason.
Or he just wanted people to think he had it so nobody would look for it.
But it's a vault, Chad. No one goes into the vault.
Somebody would have had to know that it was there. I don't know. We don't need any more. See, this right here, we don't need that. We established it's fake. Let's move on.
Okay. So what is your not so good? What is your bad? What is your no class for this movie? To borrow a phrase from a certain sports program.
I don't really have a no class. Nothing really offended me so much. So, since I kind of have a feeling where you're going to go, I'm just going to say that I wish Hela did more things. Because when Kate Blanchett was there, she was great. I like seeing her. But outside of her getting there and outside of the end fight, she's just kind of there. She does try to do something at one point, which involves her walking to a door and then walking back. That's it. So... I wish there's more to her. However, I think that we are not done with her. And if she's back in one of these next Avengers movies, then they got a little more leeway. Even though they're dealing with 60 people in those movies. But, you know, whatever.
Pepper Potts included. So, Chad. One thematic element of the previous two Thor movies have been monologues at the beginning. By Odin. That have set up your villains for your movies. We get the opening introduction about the Frost Giants and about why the Frost Giants are and where they are in the cosmos and what they do and who their leader is and what Odin's ties to them are. And that sets up the entire movie. In Thor: The Dark World, the prologue is entirely about the Dark Elves and why Malekith is so sleepy and how he wants to take over the world by sleeping. But it's, again, Odin explaining his history and explaining everything. What did we get here? The first shots of the movie are Chris Hemsworth in Sutter's little volcano there, cracking a joke to a skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
When do we get the background story on who Helena is and who she is and where she came from?
The real deep background we get in, like, the middle of the movie.
Right. And what do we get? Taking down the ceiling, revealing the fact that Odin's tried to cover up his true lineage, his true history for a long, long time, and we get a story about how Daddy banished me, and I wasn't allowed to come back until Daddy died. And so now I'm going to go down below to the crypts, which no one knew were here before now. I'm going to resurrect my dead army and my dead wolf, and I'm going to take over Asgard and the Nine Realms by going through the Rainbow Bridge.
Yep.
Tell me, Chad, when did Odin take over the Nine Realms? When did Odin do that? What years? Was it eons ago? Was it decades ago? Was it centuries ago? Because he tells us how long ago the wars between the ice people, the frost giants, and Odin are. That he tells us how long ago Malekith tried to plunge the world into darkness. They don't tell us how long ago Helena attempted her coup, because that's essentially what is alluded to, is that she tried to use her evil forces to overthrow him once he had taken over the Nine Realms and decided to stop. Also, how did Helena get concealed? Like, how did she get banished? Where did she get banished to? And what was the oath that kept her, the imaginary magical line that kept her where she was until he died? That's not shown. That's not talked about.
Mm-mm.
When did she try to escape her captivity and cause Odin to send the Valkyrie to try and stop her from escaping and coming for his throne?
Now, I always thought that was part of the coup, and he sent them and she killed them and then he went and banished
them. She explicitly says, we went to go take care of her when she tried to escape her entrapment.
Oh, well, I got nothing.
Okay. How did Valkyrie, the Tessa Thompson character, Valkyrie, how did she escape, and how did she escape Helena's vicious wrath, and how did they reseal Helena away? Like, obviously she was out far enough from her boundary that Odin had to force her back in. How did they force her back in? Did one person do it? Did 50? Was the Asgardian army involved? How did that happen?
Got nothing.
Exactly, Chad. You have nothing. Because whereas we had gotten pathos and emotion and backstory and facts and figures and information on two of the crummiest villains in the history of the MCU, the Frost Giant guy, who's basically a sub-villain because Loki's the real villain, and Malekith the Sleepy Elf, both get long monologues by Odin. We get nothing. We get a bare-bones picture of Cate Blanchett and why and how she came to be. That is one of the biggest issues I have with the movie, is too much stuff happens off screen. It gets referenced, but it's never explained. You also brought up another good one. First of all, there's an entire subplot that they shot and filmed about the slums of Asgard. Remember that from the set visit? That's all gone. Crazy Hobo Odin, completely gone in favor of melancholy, let me go home to my dead wife, Odin. Okay, so major reworking changes here from everything that was on the set visit, everything that had been talked about for a while. You mentioned when she goes to the stronghold, the armory, where very Lord of the Rings looking type armory, where Heimdall has taken the refugees from Asgard to protect them. She literally brings down the door, walks across the doors into the little cavern, the armory, and then hears Thor knocking on the throne, and within 2.5 seconds is all the way back at Asgard. How does that happen? Why does that happen? How could she hear the clanging of the throne from all the way in the outskirts of town?
Don't know.
Tell me, Chad, what wormhole did Bruce Banner's, or the Hulk's Quinjet fly into in order to land in Sakaar? And how did the Quinjet survive crashing down from said black hole down to the surface of the planet of Sakaar? Again, information that is told off screen, explained off screen. This is not good. There is exposition that needs plot holes that need to be filled. Like, if you want to, you know you have a villain problem. Why are you going to barely, bare bones sketch out your villain's motivations? If your villain's motivation is essentially, daddy banished me and I have daddy issues and he's denying his true self, he's truly a bloodthirsty emperor. I want to continue that bloodthirsty reign because that's who we truly are as leaders of Asgard. That's who we truly are as people. It is our destiny to rule over the entire realm. Then you have to explain the coup. You have to explain how she got banished because it is instantaneous. The moment Odin vanishes away to Valhalla, her portal opens up, and again, another thing that was changed from the trailers, you know, they're not in New York City, they're in Norway when, you know, when she shows up for the first time and breaks his hammer. It's instantaneous. As soon as Odin dies or goes to Valhalla, she shows up. It's clearly, that was the moniker for her release. How did we not see that? Why did we not see that? Like, that's kind of an important deal. You have to flesh out your villain, and you can do it the way you did in the previous two Thor movies in 2.5 minutes and make things better. So that's my bad. That's my not so good. That's my no class. The fact that so much stuff takes place off screen. And the other no class that I would have is, dadgummit, I know it's a comedy. I know you're playing everything for laughs. But we've been around Asgard since 2011. Jane freaking Foster has visited Asgard since 2011. She spent time there being medically cleared. Okay? It's an important place. It's the center of the Nine Realms. All of that. Thor makes a conscious decision to destroy the place to destroy his sister. He is watching. He is watching Sutter grow into an enormous being with his fire sword, looking to destroy the Nine Realms. And what do they have happened? Hulk gets up and decides, "Whoa, fire monster! Me must go destroy fire monster." Instead of just training on the shot of Asgard being completely destroyed by a fire marshal and Valkyrie and Thor having this conversation about, I always hated this prophecy, and then you start in a little, you know, parent telling child not to do that anymore thing with him and Hulk and Thor, and it takes drama away from the moment. They get on the ship, they get off of Asgard, and they're sitting there watching their homeworld be destroyed. And what do you cut to? The director as a rock monster himself making a joke about the foundations. And then once the foundations are gone, him making another joke. There's no pausing. There's no emotional moment the way there is at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which is earned, by the way. With the amount of time we spent on Asgard and the amount of history that we've laid in of Asgard, it should have the same emotional resonance as Yondu's death. And yet it's not treated with the same reverence by its director and writer. It's treated as a punchline. Ragnarok is the destruction of all things. This has been Nerd's biggest complaint since we heard Devin Faraci, all the way back when he was an active writer, do a piece that said this was Marvel's darkest script yet, and they brought in a comedy director and a comedy writer because they wanted to lighten it up. Like, Ragnarok is the end of all things, and nerds' biggest complaint is if it's the end of all things, you don't need to be doing anything other than treating it with reverence and respect that it's due. You know, the way that they did with Winter Soldier and the Fall of S.H.I.E.L.D. That's not what happened. And they took craps on the destruction of Ragnarok as it was going, the destruction of Asgard as it was going on. And if, to me, those moments deserved more weight. And that's, you know, that and the fact that you kept making fun of Joss Whedon's beautiful dialogue from Avengers Age of Ultron. But you pay it off because seeing Natasha is ultimately the thing that turns him back into Banner. So you strongly hint that that's still a connection there, a thing. So, I mean, that's my no class. That's my bad. I mean, lack of shading for your villainous, which was already in the structure of the previous two movies, and crapping on the destruction of the home planet of Asgard.
And I figured the second part would be what you touched on for your bad. And it's, you're not alone. That's what I've heard a lot of. And I mean, there's validity to it.
I mean, granted, here's the thing. It doesn't matter because we were only visiting Asgard during Thor movies. Mm-hmm. We're under the assumption that Hemsworth's deal is done. There aren't going to be more Thor movies. So you don't really have to have Asgard as a place. I think it would have been more fun and more challenging for Asgard to still exist and for Thanos to be having to make an assault on it the way he's going to have to make an assault on Nova Corps in order to get the orb. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do this, I understand it, and we pretty much knew it was going to be a thing going back to that theater announcement of the slate and making us all Google Ragnarok. But treat it with reverence and respect. Don't take a giant crap on it when James Gunn has a beautiful moment at the end of Guardians 2 that makes everybody emotional. You had the same possibilities here, and you didn't take it.
No, I get that. It's just the way they chose to play it, and it's, you know, they could have added more weight to it, but they chose to be funny.
The entire time. And that's the thing. The film clearly loves Sakaar. The film clearly loves spinning the Planet Hulk yarn. They really enjoy that. As evidenced by the fact that we barely go back to Asgard to like check on Heimdall and what he's up to. Okay? And it does those Sakaar things really, really well. And those bits are really, really funny. Another bit of continuity that is off screen. The revolution that his rock monster guy brings about the second time, off screen. So when the collector shows back up at in the second post credit tag, we have no idea how he got there. We have no idea if the revolution was actually successful. He calls it a tie. We don't see the practical impacts of a Sakaar revolution because most of the revolutionaries get on a freaking ship and go away shortly after said revolution is supposed to have happened.
Yep. I don't know. This is what I need to see again, to see if all of those things affect me in a similar way. I don't think they will, but I mean, I will notice them.
I can laugh at the movie. Like, to me, this is the closest thing to having a Wes Anderson direct a Marvel movie you're ever going to get. Wes Anderson has that very distinctive Grand Budapest Hotel, Moonrise Kingdom sense of humor that is very, you know, it's layered into every one of his movies. It's his hallmark. It's what he's known for. What TD is known for, a different kind of humor, but still known for that, for his humor. And he brought that in spades to this film. It's a funny film, but honestly, it's just like, there are moments where you need to hold the joke, and
there's no joke holding in this one.
No. So those are our thoughts on Thor Ragnarok, and we'll get into more with Jim in an upcoming episode. Jim and T-Bob will be rejoining us to talk about their thoughts on Thor Ragnarok as well. All right. So while we're on the topic of the MCU, there's a movie that is currently done, is in the vault, so to speak, is being edited. It is called Avengers Infinity War. After the events of Thor Ragnarok, we still do not know the location of the Soul Stone. But we do know that Thanos' ship is hovering above a bunch of Asgardian refugees, and Loki more than likely has something that Thanos really needs.
Mm-hmm.
So we've heard from the Russos, who, aside from doing a small interview where they said that, you know, VR is something they're really interested in exploring later on down the line, also said that they're approaching the first Infinity War movie as a heist film. What do you think of Thanos executing a heist in order to steal the stones?
Well, it makes sense considering he has, what, none right now?
As to our knowledge, none. And we know that some of these are located in very fortified places, such as Vision's Head.
Yeah. So we're going to assume, and since we've seen the unofficial leaked trailer, that he does get some stones by the time he has a fight with the Avengers.
He has to have some stones in order to call a small asteroid or moon.
Yeah. And that is with it. He doesn't have all of them, but he does have some. So, if he's like, fine, I'll do it myself, and we haven't seen him do it himself at all up until this point, then yes, it makes sense that him doing it himself will be an Infinity War, and he's going after the stones, and we'll see how he acquires all or most of them. So, it makes sense, and I'm fine with it. I just want to see what a Thanos heist movie looks like. Considering we still have to deal with our heroes and where they're at, and they're all in very different places. So how do you get all those things to work together?
I mean, they're not really in different places. I mean, at the end of Thor Ragnarok, he's on a ship trying to chart his course for Earth and gets intercepted. Which is going to be a really interesting thing, because if that is sequentially in the film where Thanos meets his first Avenger, what does that spell for the future of the Sakaar and Asgardian refugees who are on the ship?
Yeah.
Because Thanos isn't exactly a merciful being.
Yeah. I don't know if they'll throw away all of... Because, I mean, if you eviscerate that ship, you're essentially throwing away all of Ragnarok.
I think what you would end up doing is doing a Star Trek type thing and beaming Loki aboard the ship.
Yeah, I can see that. I don't think they'll do anything with the ship. Thor and Loki will end up off of it.
Unless he could have his Darth Vader moment at the beginning, and like he just burst through the door and like
kill some people.
Yeah,
as long as he doesn't kill them all, that's he can kill some. It's fine, just not all. But I mean, yeah, Thor is gonna be out in space. Since we know he ends up with the Guardians, that leaves us a question: where the hell is Hulk? He's somewhere in space. He's probably not with Thanos. Probably still on the ship, so how does he get there?
Well, we know he ends up on Earth at some point.
All the Earthbound heroes are on Earth, but they're not together.
Hulk is on the ship with Loki and Thor and Valkyrie.
Mm-hmm.
And Tessa Thompson has been spotted on set in Atlanta.
Yeah, I figured she would be there. So, we have space, we have Earth, and all the ones on Earth, and some of them are not talking to each other and all this stuff. So how does everybody end up coming together? All while Thanos is jacking these gems.
Yeah, but you know, the funny thing about Thanos to this point is the person who's given him the most shading is James Gunn.
Mm-hmm.
In a movie where Thanos never even appears.
That's true.
So you've done a lot of heavy lifting on Thanos just with dialogue, so. Mm-hmm. I mean, and remember, Tony Stark still has a phone with a Call Me Maybe attached to it.
I mean, Cap's coming, so we all know that. It's just how do they all manage to get together?
They manage to get together because there's a big freaking purple guy coming from the sky, and Peter Parker's spidey sense is tingling while he's on a train.
He's on a bus.
Right.
But still, it appears we're going to actually see them all come together. So it's going to be that and fighting Thanos while Thanos gets stoned.
You know, this is double the cast of Civil War.
Yeah.
In terms of bodies, it's double the cast of Civil War.
I mean, it's pretty much everybody living that's been in any of these movies outside of, like, a couple of ladies.
And Nick Fury.
He'll be in one. Oh, yeah, he's not in War. There's no way in hell he's not in the fourth one. No way in hell.
We'll see.
He's in the fourth one. They're shooting in Atlanta. He lives in Atlanta. It's not a thing. He's in the fourth one.
We shall see. But I mean, I think the heist movie motif is the best way to go. Especially, like I said, he has to get into Novacore. He has to destroy Novacore in order to get there and take that. He has to get to the collector's collection and destroy him to get the Aether. He has to rip Vision's head off. He has to invade the Sanctum Sorum of New York, and that's just the ones off the top of my head. He's gotta make Loki bow before him and offer up the Tesseract to him. Mm-hmm. And we still have no idea where in the hell the Soul Stone is. Like, there are rumors of maybe Himdall having it. Himdall's on the ship. There's rumors of it being involved in Black Panther because of, you know, his connectivity to, you know, the souls of former Panthers and things like that. But we still have no idea where in the heck it is in the universe. But those are all places that will require him to heist things out of places. So, I mean, the heist motif really works.
Yeah.
Makes the most sense. All right. So, Chad, let's move on to something that is near and dear to your heart, DC. We are fastly approaching the Justice League movie. And let me take this opportunity to clarify myself in my remarks on Twitter to Miss Terry Schwartz, which have been retweeted and favorited more times than any tweet I've ever issued in my existence. So my point to Miss Schwartz, which was essentially that this embargo that they are under for Justice League feels way weirder than any embargo for any comic book movie or movie period that I can remember. Literally all the journalists are able to say is, I quote, "I have seen Justice League." My point in what I was trying to convey was that does not help anyone on either end of this discussion. It doesn't help Warners get word out about the film or get people talking about the film positively or negatively. And it doesn't help the fans, because if all you know is reporter X, like Jim or Terry or, you know, Haley Fouch or whoever, Goldberg or Chitwood, like, if all you know is that person saw the movie, that's just going to cause people like me to ask them questions that they can't answer. So it doesn't help advance the discussion at all. All it just says is, I've seen it. Whereas if, for example, when people saw Homecoming, Wonder Woman is a better example. People saw Wonder Woman, they were encouraged to tweet their reactions immediately afterwards in general broad strokes. Not that you could have a specific conversation about the movie, but that you could get the conversation about the movie started in a generalized sense. They're not doing this here. It's like a full-lig Gestapo, like, if you say one word other than "I have seen Justice League," we will come and shut down your Twitter account. And the way that I phrased it to Miss Schwartz was essentially, like, this feels more intense. Like, normally you're allowed to give generalized statements about what you see. With this, all you're being able to say is, I've seen it. It doesn't help the conversation. And the response that got retweeted all over the internet was essentially, it's normal standard procedure for there to be embargoes in place. You know, it's not a sign of anything. Relax. It's fine. Which I get. That's totally the point. Yes, embargoes happen for every major movie that gets reviewed. That's perfectly fine. What I was speaking to, or trying to speak to, was a larger sense of a kind of a tighter, restrictive lid that doesn't help the conversation around the movie. It creates fear and anxiety in people who are already worried about the movie to begin with. And it creates an environment for journalists where they are asked questions they can't answer. So it doesn't do anybody good to say, here's the here's I've seen Justice League, here's some pictures of the Batmobile.
No. So, and I get that, and I agree. The thing with me was, I know there are times critics see movies way early, and they just won't say anything about seeing the movie until they can actually talk about it. What was funny to me was that every one of them would say, I'm going to see it, but then I can't say anything. Which...
It's kind of like, there have been different times where it's like, you know, after a long time, I can finally tell you X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. You know, after I saw the movie 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and I can finally release my... I can finally tell you that I've seen the movie, and this is what I thought in generalized terms. It's never really been a situation where it's like, I'm going to tell you that I'm going to see the movie, and I'm going to tell you that I've seen it, but I'm not going to be able to answer any of your questions in regards to the content or any of the movie. All I can tell you is that I saw the movie... And I had a Batlot tour where I saw a bunch of Batmobiles. The end.
Yeah, it's... I think if it were any other movie, it wouldn't be this. But because it is Justice League and everything surrounding Justice League...
Right, and my tone came off condescending because it was like I was trying to explain to somebody who does this for a living, you know, how these things normally work. And it was... I was just trying to draw a comparison between the way it's been done... Like, no spoilers, no, like, you know, you've seen the kind of stuff Frosty will put. He'll just go through in a generalized manner and say, this is what I thought of the movie. And, you know, several of them, Jim will do that. Several others will do that. Like, that's, to me, is more standard operating procedure than this, where it feels like it's just a tight lid. Like I said, if you say anything other than, I have seen Justice League... They will come and shut down your Twitter account. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't trying to be disrespectful of Ms. Schwartz. I wasn't trying to be condescending in any kind of way. I was just trying to draw the parallel that, look, yeah, embargoes happen, but this seems like a really tight embargo for a movie that they already know has marketing issues.
Mm-hmm. No, I get it. Yeah, it's strange all the way around. But, hopefully...
And, yeah, and you have a London press junket where you, like, put the entire cast out there and let them answer questions at a press conference.
But I've seen that done before where they're junkets and they show pictures and stuff of the junkets. And my operating thought is that those people asking the questions can't... They won't ask these questions unless they've already seen the movie. Well, so
unless you're Disney and Star Wars...
Yeah.
And you can make somebody go to a junket for a movie they haven't seen yet.
Yeah, unless it's that. But normally, I know they've seen the movie, but they can't talk about it. And I just, they'll put up their interviews and stuff. And I'm like, okay, this is nice to see. I know they've seen it, and I never think anything else about it. But yeah, this movie needs to be good here.
So what do you make of the Batman 89 score making a return?
God damn it. Again, I've been on record saying that I really, really like...
The Batman suite.
The Batman suite from Batman vs. Superman. However, doesn't seem like we're getting that in comments that Danny Elfman has made. He's pretty much said, there's only been one Batman theme in his mind. He didn't say it in such a condescending and cocky way, but still, that's what he said.
Which makes sense, because the Batman 89 theme is the one that got used for the Batman the animated series.
And- yeah.
And still carried on a little bit over into Schumacher's movies. So
yeah, so I get that, but there's a bunch of clips, and one of them shows Batman, and you can hear the theme, and like the scene is cool. It just for me, it kind of rubs me the wrong way because I really, really like that theme, and I'm not going to get it. So I just have there's a part of me that just has to get over it. I'm going to curse a lot when I see the movie when I hear these things anyway, but. That's just me listening to an interview with Henry Cavill. It does seem like we're going to still get some of the Zimmer theme of Man of Steel, which I guess is all I can ask for.
Well, that should occur during the resurrection.
I think the part that they released that was not supposed to be released, that you hear the John Williams theme, I think that is part of the resurrection. So after that, if we get the Man of Steel theme, I may be okay.
Okay. Speaking of Superman, Chad, Mr. Cavill had some comments this week regarding the DC Expanded Universe. What do you make of his comments that if Marvel hadn't existed, DC would still be behind?
I mean, his comments are true. Like, in the easiest way to say it, it's true. It's just that DC tried to go a certain way.
Let's execute this quote here. Even if Marvel didn't exist, we'd struggle. There was a style they, DC, were going for, and an attempt to be different and look at things from a slightly different perspective, which hasn't necessarily worked. This is people acknowledging that Zack screwed up. Yes, it has made money, but it has not been a critical success. It hasn't given everyone that sensation which superhero movies should give the viewer. I think it is a wonderful time for the female hero. It is the perfect setting in social politics right now. We need it. We want that perspective. And Wonder Woman has struck at the ideal time and has become a phenomenal success, which is fantastic. Any success within the superhero universe, especially within the DC universe, is wonderful because I want to keep telling the Superman story. Selfishly, that works for me. Somewhere Matthew Vaughn is hearing that. I feel like now the right mistakes have been made and they haven't been pandered to. And we can start telling the stories in the way they need to be told. It is even better to come back from a mistake or stylistic error into the correct vein because it will make it seem that much stronger. Wonder Woman was the first step in the right direction.
Everything he said is true. It's more or less what people like me have been saying forever, that they chose to go. They let, for all the people that think that Warner Brothers like stepped in on Batman versus Superman, I think that was a Zack movie, and Zack went the way he wanted to go.
Remember, the executives gave it a standing ovation.
Yeah, well, the executives also don't understand Superman. But
Apparently there was a mandate, allegedly, of a under 2-hour runtime from a Warner Brothers exec at one point.
That's for Justice League.
Yeah.
Which that they have their hands more on Justice League than they do in Batman vs Superman. Batman vs Superman, I think the exec stepped in to trim the runtime down from the 3 hours Zach had to.
Yeah, I think in fairness, I think we go from the Batman vs Superman extended cut to what we see in the theater, which is about, what, 20 minutes worth of footage?
Yeah, 20, 30, something like that.
20, 25 minutes worth of footage. I mean, and that makes sense.
But the problem with that movie is Zack's overall style and the story he wanted to tell.
The extended cut does not change how good that movie is.
I mean, it makes it, you can understand some things better, but it at the core, it's the vision of these characters is not what the vision of the character should be or what people think they should be. And that is what Henry is speaking to in this. And in saying that Wonder Woman is a step in the right direction, it is a director's vision that has a clear vision of what the character is that lines up with what the vision of what everyone else's vision of the character is and tells a story. And that is the direction that DC needs to go in. It seems like they are trying to go in. So when he says these comments, I'm in agreement with him.
But how are they going to navigate the next 3 weeks without sounding like they're taking a dump on a man who had to step away, allegedly only had to step away from directing this movie because his daughter died?
Well, they've already started with the press tour. They're
We know his daughter died.
Yeah.
But it just is more and more and more seeming like that was an opportune moment to get changes made.
Well, in the tour, the thought seems to be that this is Zack's movie and this is a story that he wants to tell. He had to step away. Josh did some things different, but he's still in line with what Zack wanted to do. So, in regards to this movie, that is the line they're towing. Now, in regards to moving forward, that's where you get these comments like this that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have gone this way, maybe we should have done something different. And I think that's how they're going to have to play it.
So the way that they're basically going to play it is, we know, we're just going to put this out there, we're going to get through it, but Zach's gone, we know Wonder Woman was a success, we know why Wonder Woman was a success, we're going to move in this direction. It's why you had the Geoff Johns stories floating out there in the trades a few months ago about what role he actually had in DC until this point.
Yeah.
It's them trying to win the PR war of, let's get through this, it'll be a Justice League movie, it'll be Zach's Justice League movie for the majority. You won't have to sit there and pick apart every scene and go, is that a Zach scene or is that a Joss scene? And once this is over, Aquaman's coming down the pike with James Wan. It's going to be weird and different. And we'll probably have a Wonder Woman 2 after that. And we'll go from here.
Yep.
Don't forget there's also the Joker Origins movie with Todd Phillips.
Yeah. We can forget about that right now. One thing at a time. Justice League is the only thing that matters right now.
And Suicide Squad 2, who can't find a director.
Again, one thing at a time. The only other thing that kind of matters is...
Shazam.
Yes.
Which we can move on to now because it's the next movie that's going... DCEU movie going before cameras. So, Chad, how do you do a Shazam movie? Not to be confused with a Shaquille O'Neal movie of the somewhat similar type.
It's Kazam. I never understand why that's confusing.
Yeah. Well, because it's the same concept.
No, it's not. Kazam was a genie. Out of a boombox. Yes.
You say this as an authority on Shaquille O'Neal's worst acting job ever.
Because I've seen the movie because I have little brothers.
I saw the movie too, years and years ago. But Shazam has been getting casting. Zachary Levi goes from being stabbed by Helena and leaving the MCU to walking over the street to the DCEU and playing the embodiment of the superhero Shazam. And we learned today that Asher Angel from the Disney Channel is going to play the child counterpart to Shazam, Billy Batson. We also learned that in a movie that will not feature Black Adam, the villain will be Dr. Shivana and Mr. Take Me Home Country Roads himself, Mr. Mark Strong, is in talks to British up the Shazam movie as the villain. Your thoughts, sir, on everything Shazam related right now?
So, Mark Strong is a great choice. I love him and everything he's done.
Including Green Lantern?
Including Green Lantern. I thought he was the best part of Green Lantern. I wanted him to come back. I wanted him to be Sinestro. They could have scrapped everything and kept him, and I would have been fine. But, you know, for Dr. Savannah, it's fine. So I'm assuming they're going to go the new 52 route with Dr. Savannah. And I don't really know as much about that, but it just seems like from the pictures and things, it looks like that'll probably be the way to go. Because otherwise, Dr. Savannah is just a mad scientist. He's like Shazam's Lex Luthor. To the two guys that will embody our hero, Asher Allen, I don't know anything about him because he's a Disney Channel kid and I'm grown for Disney Channel, those kind of shows, so I don't know anything about him. He looks like he can play the part. That's fine. The bigger thing is Zachary Levi as Shazam, which I saw this news while I was texting you when I saw this, and I was actually talking to my brother, and I saw it, and it took a second, and I'm like, yes, I'm behind this, because I'm a fan of his, and I've seen him in Chuck, and he has this, you know, this boyish quality
about
him.
He has the boyish quality, and he has the humor quality and the comedic timing to pull it off.
Yeah, and I think that is more important than actually looking like you ate a cow every day to be this big jack dude. So I know a lot of people are concerned because he's not the biggest guy. But
that'll make for a good juxtaposition against Dwayne Johnson.
I mean, they're going to beef him up anyway. I don't think he'll get as big as Chris Hemsworth, but he'll be big enough and he'll cut enough of a figure. And then, yes, when we finally do get to Black Adam, he will be, it'll be a nice juxtaposition, even though they're close to the same height. Zachary Levi is really tall. It's just that he's kind of thin right now. So I'm looking forward to it. Like, it really got me excited for Shazam for the first time, in a while. It's really ratcheted up my excitement.
All right. And speaking of that Black Adam movie, it now has a writer. The guy who brought you Alvin and the Chipmunks the Road Chip is going to write the Shazam movie.
The Black Adam movie. And I'm going to keep this really short and really sweet.
Black Adam, yes.
I don't believe this movie is going to happen until it happens. This movie is getting the same treatment as Avatar. You got to show me something first. So,
not like Dwayne Johnson's looking for work.
No, not at all. And with this list of movies to his credit, I ain't thrilled. I'm not thrilled. Not at all. So, yeah, that's all I got to say about Black Adam. He should be in the Shazam movie, but whatever.
All right. So let's move back over to Disney real quick. So, the Circle of Life is complete. Jon Favreau tweeted out his cast list, which included a very, very, very important name that was rumored about months and months ago and brought joy to your heart because you believed that she would do the soundtrack, which would make the soundtrack, again, almost as best-selling as it was the first time with Elton John.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, sir, on Beyoncé joining the cast of The Lion King?
I think I've said it all the last time we talked about it, but I think this is good news. I know a lot of people have issues with Beyoncé because they think she's only going to be Beyoncé as Nala, which is, you know, valid. She's not the best actress, but...
Right, but your two leads are now African-Americans.
I mean, the everybody in this cast, much like Black Panther, is black except for Zazu, Timon, and Pumbaa. I think that's it. So... I knew they were going to fill it with an African-American. Well, once they said Beyoncé, I was like, if they say Beyoncé, it's going to be Beyoncé. They just have to work out the deals. And then to find out that it wasn't really the actor deal that was the hang-up. It was the music deal because you got to go through music studios and all this stuff. So that further solidifies that this is going to be a Beyoncé album when it comes out, which is a whole other thing to get excited about if you're a Beyoncé fan. So I think just the cachet of all the names and then to say you pulled in Beyoncé, who is not the best actor of this bunch, but her name does carry that kind of weight.
But Nyla was never the critical piece of infrastructure there. Like, her major function is to get Simba to come back and take his rightful place.
Yeah, but you can best believe that Nyla's going to be fleshed out a little bit more.
And she's also going to sing Can You Feel the Love Tonight.
Oh yeah, I was just about to say that. There is no doubt in my mind. Can You Feel the Love Tonight is a Beyoncé song from now on. That's what's going to happen.
Her and Donald Glover.
I guess he's singing it too, but I would assume that she's going to sing the whole thing.
It's going to go from a duet to a solo.
It was never really a duet.
It was. She sings the first part.
No, they never sing. They don't sing. It's like another. It's another voice singing.
Yeah.
Timon and Pumbaa started off.
Timon and Pumbaa started off, and then you go, the king I know he is, the king I see inside.
Oh well, okay. We're both right. Because she's not actually, like, singing it to him. It's just, like, a voiceover singing thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, it is her. I think she's going to actually sing it to him this time. So, you know, it's going to be fun to see.
It's going
to
be emotional.
I don't know about that, but, you know.
It's going to be emotional for people to, like, have those nostalgic feels and see some of the best photorealistic CGI ever created.
Yes, indeed.
Because it's not an animated movie, Chad. It's a live-action movie.
I'm not starting this argument. I don't know what to call it. So, whenever Disney decides what they're calling it, that's what I'll call it.
Whatever Disney decides to enter it into the Academy Awards race with.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Chad. There is a man who put out a music album. His name is Tyrese. And Tyrese is not very happy right now. Because The Rock laid the smacketh down on him. On Twitter. So you know what... Do you know what Tyrese has decided to do?
Tyrese is an idiot.
Tyrese has openly declared on Twitter he is open to boycotting the Fast and the Furious franchise. The only paycheck this man has left. Because he does not want to work with Dwayne Johnson ever again. Because he robbed his children and his family.
You normally host the show. But right now I'm saying this topic gets 1 minute. 1 minute, and I'm going to rail on Tyrese a little bit. Tyrese is insane, All right. So people clearly don't love him because they're not taking his phone away or his social media. He is doing some really, really stupid stuff. As Brian said, this is the only, well, it's not the only check he has left because he has a rap album coming out along with the R&B album he already has out. This is not, but he's out there caught. He's telling Universal, you're going to pick me or The Rock. Okay, which one am I going to pick? The guy that's been a side character. Yes, he's been in Transformers, in the Fast movies. Or The Rock, who is part of resurrecting this franchise. Oh, I don't know. That's a hard decision. Tyrese, maybe we'll see you later. We'll see if we got something for you down the line. Dwayne, come on into this office. Don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out, Tyrese. So in Tyrese's core argument, I kind of agree with him. Except he's going about it all the wrong way. So now I want him.
No, he's not. All of this gets done in public anyway. There's nothing.
Not like this.
There's nothing that goes on in the Fast and Furious franchise that is not public knowledge, Chad.
No, so there's beef between The Rock and Vin Diesel, and it's alluded to, but it's never outright said. Tyrese is like broken the code. He's like, nope, this is what is going on. I don't like this dude because he's doing this. Him or me, him or me. And Universal's like, you really don't want to do that. And he's still like, him or me. Dude, no. Just sit there. Shut up. You going through some other stuff. I understand. But you can't do this way because you're going to lose. People will be on your side if you went about it a different way. Or the way you're going about it, you're going to lose. And I've talked about Tyrese for more than a minute. I'm done. Done.
So, Chad, do you think Roman Banks comes back for Fast 9?
No, indeed.
All right. That'll about do it for this week's podcast. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
At The Mets Theory.
And next week, we will be live talking to Jim and T-Bob and getting their reactions to Thor Ragnarok. All right. Thank you very much and have a pleasant evening.